Okay, this is a speaker meeting. Stacia will speak for 10 minutes and then turn the meeting over to our main speaker, Richard, who will share his experience, strength, and hope. I'll turn you.
Hi, I'm Stacia, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Stacia.
I'm really happy to be here. I'm a little bit nervous because there's so many of you, and this is very important, I think. My sobriety date is August 11, 2013, so I'm getting really close to my 2 years. I have a sponsor who has a sponsor, and I have 3 sponsees who are all awesome. And, and I work the program as best as I can, which is different amounts at different times. So I grew up outside of Washington, D.C. I grew up in a loving home. I grew up feeling like I felt different, like all the different people that I turned out to be very similar to. But I did not know that at that time. I felt so alone and afraid. And all the tools that I now have, I really needed like 34 years ago, really bad. When I started drinking, I was already so ready for it. I'd been ready for it for like 10 years when I had my first drink at 12 or 13. And it went down so easily. It fit in so well with my super secret lifestyle that was kind of based on nothing, but was just how I rolled. So it was really easy for me to isolate and to drink and to hide it and to, you know, just to use that tool to keep my feelings bottled up and to keep going. And I never had very much luck using alcohol to be really socially successful. I mostly just used it to feel better. And that worked for me for a while. I had consequences right away, and I don't have time to go into a really long story of my many consequences. But my drinking, I'm such a terrible, terrible drinker that there were so many stops and starts along the way because I drank. I drank like I was going to die any minute, and so I often almost did and then really needed to stop. And then I would stop for a while until I would start. And my life moved like that for a lot of years. But just to give an example of some of my funnest adventures in drinking, and this is like very typical of my drinking, but I remember I was living in Berkeley. I moved to Berkeley when I was 19 to try to start my new life, to try to hopefully not drink if possible. That didn't work, but I did all the same stuff, and I was still there. And so anyway, one night I started drinking, and I was feeling kind of restless, irritable, and discontent as usual, maybe more so. I had had a fight with my boyfriend, who I felt was capable of fixing me because he had a lot of meth, and that was a very grounding experience for my blackout drinking ass. But, you know, still not the best avenue. But anyway, we had a fight, and I thought, fuck it. I'm going to go out, and I'm going to feel better. And I remember, like, just getting all prepared for this event of walking into town aimlessly and like, I put on these fancy boots and this really short skirt and my favorite T-shirt that said Onward Through the Fog, which was, like, my prayer that I was constantly sending out. Even if there was, like, clarity to the left or right, I would prefer to walk straight through the fog. And I totally did. But anyway, so I'm in town, and I'm drinking and going to different places and trying to meet up with friends. And I blacked out, like, so soon into the evening that I really have no idea what happened. But what I do remember is waking up with none of those very lovely clothes in the Berkeley drunk tank, like, banging on the door for them to let me the fuck out. Like, what was I doing here? Get me out of here. And I had no clothes on except for this oversized sweatshirt, which was not mine. I had no memory of anything except for walking into downtown Berkeley looking just fine. And And they did let me out at about 6 in the morning, which was many hours after I started pounding. And they opened the door and they said, all right, that's it. You're free to go. And I said, what'd you do with my clothes? And they said, that's how you came in. And I felt like, wow, that is not good. And so the way that I was able to get home was in this oversized sweatshirt and nothing else, was that they issued me a paper suit and some foam booties. And so I put on the paper suit and the foam booties, and I, you know, they said, who do you want to call to come and get you? And I thought, wow, nobody can know about this. Like, I'll just make my own way home. And so I started making my own way home, and I thought, man, I look weird. Somebody's going to know something is not right. So what do I do? And I decided to start jogging, and I felt like if I kept an even clip, that maybe people would just think I'm out for a jog at 6 in the morning, and it would be fine. And it was and was not fine. I did make it home, and I did survive that experience. And I had many other experiences like that. And usually things like that would prompt me to stop drinking or to do other things for periods of time. But alcohol is like my main squeeze. There's nothing between me and it when things hurt. And things often hurt, and I really didn't have any tools. So that kept going for a while, and at some years later, my partner and I came up with the bright idea that maybe if I got pregnant, that would help the alcoholism. It seemed like a really crazy idea, but I was, you know, I was out of ideas, and it was kind of like, it's so crazy, it just might work. It did not work. I mean, it worked for exactly 9 months, and then it stopped working because it's really hard to have an infant. But what did happen to me was that I was so shamed by that experience of blacking out while caring for my infant, which I did a couple of times and then finally was busted. But, like, literally, there was no way I was just going to voluntarily stop doing that on my own, even with this child that I loved with all my heart. I got busted, I felt ashamed, and I knew everything had to change. So I put into action this very involved plan of lots of education and lots of being a mom and lots of, like, sucking it up. And I already had some experience white-knuckling it, so I felt like I could do it. And I did do it for 5 years, and, you know, I was very distracted. That's the main tool I came to this program with. I am capable of becoming very distracted and of cutting off things, like parts of myself and parts of the world that I do not like. And that's been one of the hardest things to kind of work on in sobriety. But so I was able to do that for a period of time. And then 5 years later, for whatever reason, I just wasn't able to do it anymore. I was sitting on my couch. I could think of 3 things that were wrong, and that was too many things. And now I must drink. And I did drink. And lots of things happened inside of me over the years. And I was more successful at drinking. But being more successful at drinking for me really doesn't mean shit. It just meant that I isolated more. I tried not to talk to anybody. I tried not to know anybody. I tried not to go out. I tried to wait until my son was asleep to start drinking and all these different things that sort of worked. But towards the end of this other experiment, which lasted for like a year and a half, I was just drinking daily, and I was starting to hallucinate a little bit, and I was pretty sure I was already dead. Maybe my child was already dead. And like, it was just, things were crazy. But I could not stop drinking because it was like my only source of relief. And even up until the end, that was true. And again, I kind of put myself in a situation where I got busted by people who cared about me. And for whatever reason, I was just so done. I was so tired of feeling that ashamed for that long. Yeah, and then I stopped again. And what was different about stopping, I'd already tried AA a tiny bit, like 13 years previously, but I knew that I couldn't do it by myself. That's the one thing I was able to prove with all the drinking. Like, I can't stop on my own. And I need to do something drastic, and I need to do it all the way. And I didn't have a good idea of what that thing was. And even going to AA, going to at least a meeting every day, I still go to a meeting every day. I probably went to much more than that in the beginning. But things started to change slowly, and I really believe in the program, and I've started to feel things that I just haven't ever felt in my life, like compassion and belonging, and like just feeling care for other human beings in a way that's different. And I mean, I'm in and out of that, you know. I still have a lot of my same bullshit, but one thing I've noticed is I do not drink over it, and I don't know why. And I do believe in a higher power, because everything in me believes I should drink, and that is my solution. But I just don't do it, and I don't feel the need in the same way. But it has a lot to do with like just constant maintenance. And I listen to the tools, and I try to use the tools, and sometimes it's hard to use them. But even just having them and having the network of people that I have is so helpful. Okay. Yeah, so I guess I'm going to end with that, but I'm so grateful to be here. I love this meeting, and I'm so grateful that all of you have come to it. And, yeah, I hope you find some of the things that I found in the program. Thank you.
Can you punch me at 10 minutes or something? Okay. Hi, I'm Richard. I'm an alcoholic. It's so sappy to say, but I remember when Stacia came in, and when she came, we were speaking together. It was we used to high five in meetings. Like, I remember your first 30 days. It was really cool. I'm so glad you're here. Okay, I'm going to shut up about that, I promise. There are a lot of you here tonight. That's really cool. And look, if you're new, I'll say this, and then you can blot out everything else I say. But if you're new, the itch goes away. That's what I wanted to hear when I came in here. That's what I've discovered to be true. I'm not one of those people who got sober and the cravings went away immediately. I had cravings for a long time. I had intense cravings for quite a while. Probably got a little bit of relief right around 10 months. But I kept coming back. And, you know, to tell you the truth, I've got a thinking problem. I'm really crazy. But I'm not insane today, and I can't remember the last time I had a thought about drinking alcohol. You know, it's just living life today. Life is good. I was thinking on the way over here about the fellowship, because I knew this is kind of a big meeting, and I was thinking about a night. I was about six years sober, and I was 19 years old. And I came home from a meeting one night, and I just wanted to be alone by myself. I'd been planning this all week. I couldn't wait. And when I got home, I heard a knock on the door, and this dude from a meeting showed up, and he wouldn't go away. And then I got another knock on the door, and this woman from a meeting showed up. And then, like, all these people just started showing up at my place, and they wouldn't leave. I tried to kick them out, and they freaking wouldn't leave. And they didn't plan this either. This was just random people coming over and showing up at my apartment, and all from the program. And I tried to kick them out. They wouldn't leave. They drug me downstairs. We wound up in the pool. None of us had bathing suits, so we wound up naked. And I'm thinking, you know, how did my peaceful evening at home alone become this crazy co-ed, sober, skinny-dipping party thing? And after that, they drug me back upstairs, and that was the night. They were all still there when I got the call. That was the night I got the call that informed me my little brother had terminal cancer. And it was serious, and I had to get down there right then. And I am so very grateful for those people in the program who came over and listened to that small, still voice inside instead of listening to me when I told them to get the hell out. And that's what this fellowship is really all about to me. I love you guys. I love you guys a lot. There's nothing better than running buddies that are sober alcoholics. I love you too much. I got to go to Al-Anon because. My drunkalog is whatever. I'd rather talk about recovery, but I better qualify first. So I was born in Oklahoma, born and raised in Oklahoma. In case you're wondering why I'm so sophisticated, my father was a bull rider. He was a cop. He had a John Wayne complex. He was one of those guys. My mother, we were Native American on both sides of our family, but the European genes won on my father's. And my mother's, like, looked the part, and she was kind of this hippie wild child that nobody could control, straight-out alcoholic right out of the gate. They got married. It was a very violent marriage. The first emotion I ever remember feeling in my life was terror. Not fear, but just actual terror. I was terrorized as a child all the time. I never felt right. I felt like my skin was really thin, and everything got in. And I always walked around feeling like there was this big hole in me that the wind blew through. That's how I felt all the time. That was sobriety to me. I had my first drink when I was 9 years old, helping an old lady walk across the street. She had fallen on her walker, and I helped her walk home, and these college guys had seen me do it, and they were having a party. They gave us a beer. We went into this bush cave. My buddy and I, is this fence and a bush that made a cave, and a lot of stuff happened in there that wound up on my fifth step later, but that's where I had my first drink, and it was a beer. And my buddy took a sip, and he spit it out, and he said, "It tastes like hell." And I took a sip, and it tasted like shampoo, and I hate it, and I said, "It tastes like hell." And then I drank more. And then I drank more, and then I drank more, and then I drank more, and then the whole thing was gone. And I hated it. I hated the taste. That was the first time in my life I ever felt okay. The first time ever. I was totally in love, man. Alcohol and I had a passionate love affair, and, you know, those always end badly. But I felt okay in my skin, and I had to get more. And it was a lot of work getting booze at that age, so I wound up doing a lot of other things because they were easy to get a hold of. But my first love and my last love was alcohol. I loved whiskey. I loved the way it kicked. I loved the way it made me feel like my spine was, you know, made out of wood. It made me feel like a man should, you know. Knocked me right off of my ass at 10 years old, but I kept drinking it, you know. Like, I didn't like the taste. It knocked me on my ass. There were all these bad effects. I just kept drinking it. And I was not one of these alcoholics who needs a drink. I deserved a drink. You guys have no idea the kind of shit I had to deal with in elementary school. The social pressure that they put us under back then. And when I came home, I needed a drink, damn it. And so I raided my friends' parents' liquor cabinets. I was very organized. I knew whose parents were going out of town when. I knew how to steal booze. I learned how to put on an Oliver Twist face so that I could walk to this seedy bar not far from my house and ask an adult, give him a bill, and say, "Hey, please, sir, will you go in? It's for my mother." And he, "Oh, poor thing, sure, we go in." This is money that I stole from my mother. Like, but my mom, it's great setup. My mom was an alcoholic, too. So, you know, like, I was always worried that she was going to notice I was drinking her booze and stealing her money. She never noticed at all. I mean, if I could go back, well, I don't want to go back. But that was my drinking. I drank like that right up until I was 14 years old. And look, I was doing some other things, okay? That's all I got to say. And I wasn't afraid of dying. I was afraid, I was terrified of becoming a vegetable. And I drank alone. I was not a partier. I may have started with you because you had something, but I always went back to a dark room where I played a sad record, sometimes too slow, and I got a gun. And I sat there with the gun, listened to the sad record, and I drank. And that was how I did it. I was doing some other things that were getting me in my trouble. My mother had taken me to every psychologist, psychiatrist, counselor, therapist in town. And it was a game to me. Let's see, you know, how well I can outsmart the therapist. And I generally won. Until she took me to this guy who was another recovering alcoholic, as well as a psychiatrist. And he saw right through my BS, and he locked me up that night. He said, "You've got 2 months, and you're dead. If I don't lock you up tonight, you're in terrible, terrible trouble." And so I've heard enough of you. Stick around a while, go back out, and then come back in and tell me that you pick right up where you left off. I left off with 2 months to live, and I know that. So they locked me up. He said I was going to be locked up for 2 weeks. I was locked up for 2 months. And when I came out, I went to one meeting a week. That was plenty. I had shit to do. But I had these crazy thoughts, man. I was crazy new. Like I said, I had cravings for a while, and I was locked up for 2.5 months. But when I came out, like, I remember walking down the street and seeing a truck coming, and thinking, what if my body just throws itself in front of this truck? Now, I don't want to do that, but what if my body just does it without my permission? Like, I had thoughts like that because I was so used to planning on being here but winding up over here somehow, right? And I knew I couldn't trust myself, and I was totally insane. And one night, I couldn't handle it anymore. So I was walking. I'd stolen a bill. I was walking to that seedy bar to get an adult to buy me a drink. And on the way to the bar, I passed a gas station, and there was my buddy Doyle. Doyle was about 9 months sober, and he was on fire. And he saw me, and he came running over. Doyle was huge. He was massive. He was 7 foot tall. You know, he picked me up, threw me up in the air like a baby, and then shook me. How long have you been sober now? And I told him, it was great. Don't you ever stop coming back. That was great. And, you know, Doyle died drunk, you know, but he saved my life. From that moment on, I realized I was going to screw this thing up. So I went from one extreme to the other. And I had it. My home group met every night of the week except for Tuesday. And what I did is I got a key. And when I got out of detention after school, I would walk to my home. I always had detention. I would walk home to my home group and I would let myself in and I would sit there until the meeting started that night because that's the only place I ever felt safe. And where I got sober, people showed up an hour early and we all had this great bullshit session before the meeting and then we all went out after the meeting. So there were like three meetings right in a row. Sobriety, I've been sober 25 years. This is a quarter century of adventures that I shouldn't have had. And it hasn't all been a bed of roses. You know, and if you're new and you're wondering what sobriety is like, you know, I can tell you, you know, there was a night I was a soldier for a while and I was in Iraq in 2005. I was in a tower and this kid had died just outside of the gate and he burned to death in a really horrible way. We had tried to help him, but we couldn't. And it bugged me. I didn't know him. I didn't know this kid, but it really got to me on an emotional level. And I'd been there for a while. I was really stressed out. Everybody else that I worked with had a stash. And they went and took their stash and they went back and they came back the next morning and they didn't talk about it. I spent that whole night awake thinking about that kid, thinking about my stepdad who was having heart problems, thinking. And I was awake all night long. I knew that I was the only one awake and my prayers seemed to do this. And there have been nights, I'm not going to lie to you, that's been sobriety. You know, not long after that, I was on the Mediterranean in a boat with two people in recovery having the time of my life. And there have been days when that has been recovery, you know. But most days, I get up a little earlier than I think I have to. I go to a job that I can be grateful for or not, which is really my choice. And I get to work these steps on a daily basis. I really love my life today because something happens. I had a sponsee ask me this week, actually. He asked, how the fake are you when you share in meetings? Because my sponsor used to tell me, you know, bring the problem to me, bring the solution to the group. So, you know, that's just kind of my code of ethics. And when I go to meetings, something happens to me. And I'm not going to lie to you. I've had mornings where I'm crazy. I'm in my head. I'm yelling. I want to murder everybody in traffic. But when I walk through that doorway, something happens. I suddenly stop and go, wait a minute. I should be dead. I shouldn't have two small children. I shouldn't have this job, I shouldn't have this car, I shouldn't have these clothes, I shouldn't be here. Like, I should have been gone a long time ago. I should have died laying face down in a ditch, still thinking that I was right, and still looking down on everybody else. And I didn't. So, I mean, I don't think it's fake. When I come to meetings, my perspective changes like that. You know, whatever problems I have today, I suddenly remember I should be dead. So I was sober 2 years. I came home one night. I'm going to breeze through my story, and then I want to talk about the steps a little bit. But I came home one night, and my stepdad, alcoholism is a family disease. And my mother got sober about the same time that I did. And the more recovered we got, the more paranoid and crazy he got. And I came home one night. He had my little sister in a headlock, and he had a loaded gun pointed at me. And I'd been intimidated by this guy all my life, but I got the gun away from him, and I got my mom and my sister somewhere safe. And I was depressed for 2 years, but I was sober. You know, I kept coming back, I kept working the steps, and eventually, after working the steps again and again, and getting to deeper layers of the onion, and being with you, I broke through to a new freedom and a new happiness, different than the first one that I had. I joined the Army at 17. I had a lot of adventures. I was a regimental training sergeant when I left. I had a year, man, like I told you about my brother. I mean, just the worst country and western song you've ever heard. My cousin died, my brother died, my dog died, my grandpa died. I think there was another one I've forgotten now. I broke my leg. I couldn't work. They were calling me every day telling me they were going to take away my piece of shit car that I had to have to get to my crappy job that didn't pay enough for my piece of shit car. Do I look pretty? I'm going to take this jacket off. I've had periods in sobriety. This will not be your adventure. This was mine. I've had periods in sobriety when I broke my leg and all those funerals were going on. I had a bad year. I stole food to eat because I was poor. The lights were turned off. The electricity was turned off. This is Oklahoma in the middle of the winter. It's freezing cold, and I'm walking around on, like, a little cane, right? And I've got a blanket and a lantern, a candle-burning lantern. And you people came over to hang out. And you know what? Here's the funny thing about it. Some of you had money, and you could have fixed it, and I didn't ask, and you didn't offer. You just came and spent the night with me. You know, and one night they brought this beatbox, this battery powered beatbox, and some glow sticks. This was the 90s, and we had a dance party in my freezing cold apartment that had no electricity. I mean, you know, that's this fellowship. I mean, it's really this fellowship. I freaking love you guys. I freaking love you guys. I went to Iraq, came back, worked the steps, got a new freedom and a new happiness. I met a girl in Paris. I married her. We had two children. I went to Al-Anon, worked the steps, we got divorced, we're cool. this has been a gift. Now, in my family, divorce was a declaration of war. Guns were coming out. I experienced some very violent divorces as a child. I got to have, thanks to this program, the most wonderful, kind, loving, and caring divorce you could possibly imagine. It's almost disgusting how well this thing went. And we're great friends today, you know, and we co-parent our children, you know, very well. We're just not going to be married anymore. This program gave me that gift. I'm getting a redo right now. About same time period that the crazy co-ed sober skinny dipping party happened, I wanted to get educated. I wanted to be educated. I really wanted to be educated. And I filled out this application to the University of Oklahoma. And they sent back and said I was accepted, but they needed a $125 application fee. And I didn't have $125. I was so poor. And I was crying at my mailbox. And I remember telling my higher power, this is what I said, I'm going to go to Berkeley. I'm going to go to California, and I'm going to go to Berkeley. Because back then, tuition was free if you were a resident. And I said, I'm going to go to California, I'm going to become a resident, I'm going to go to Berkeley, I'm going to flip Oklahoma off from Berkeley. That was my plan. Didn't happen. Now, I've been all over the planet, done a lot of crazy adventures, never wound up in California. 2 years ago, for other reasons, I wound up in Berkeley. I live in Albany. And somebody found me on LinkedIn because of this data set that I have on my thing, and they said, would you like to come guest lecture for me at UC Berkeley? And I did that a few times, and a couple of weeks ago I got an offer, hey, would you like to come teach a class? So see, this is the shit you guys are going to miss if you don't stay. Like, sometimes it takes 18 years, right? And it's like, you know, my higher power is like, you know, this whole thing about going and being a student at Berkeley, that won't happen. But 18 years later, okay, would you like to teach there? Like, stay. I'm not kidding. Stay. I mean, these things happen. I couldn't walk on a college campus without having a panic attack. I think that goes back to some of my ancestral roots. Today I can actually stand up and give a lecture. And that's a pretty cool thing. My story is just my story. Every alcoholic has one. But one of the benefits of being sober a long time is I've worked the steps a lot. And I found a few things that worked for me. And I'd like to share with you my adventure through the steps, if you'd like to hear it. Step one, there are two parts. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol and our lives were unmanageable. So I had no problem admitting I was powerless over alcohol. That was not my issue. I knew damn well. I knew that long before I ever walked in here. I didn't have no issues there. I had an issue believing that my life was unmanageable. When I came in here, alcohol had stopped working. Alcohol was the only thing that shut my head up. It made the conflict and the noise go away until it didn't. And one day, it just didn't. The drinking made the voices louder. It made the conflict louder. And alcohol had stopped working, but I still had so much self-pity that I still thought that you were the problem, that the world was the problem and alcohol was still the solution. Like I said, I had a love affair with alcohol. Alcohol was the best friend I ever had in my life. And it took working with my sponsor and listening to your stories to turn my priorities around about what mattered. See, my world was really small when I was drinking. Of course, I was a preteen, but I don't think that would have changed. My old life was about I hate you, I love you, and then switching those two back and forth. Like, that was, like, my life. So step two, I had one of those grumpy grand sponsors coming up in the program, and he'd bark at me sometimes. One of the things that he told me was, there's nothing new in the steps except for surrendering and letting go. You've done all this before. And I was like, okay. I didn't believe it. I do now. So when I read step two, I kind of have this thing where I read it wrong, and I read, we immediately figured out which religion was white, what God looked like, and how to manipulate that power into doing my will. But that's not what it says. It says, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And I was one of those super defiant people who thought I didn't need a damn God. You know, I was so independent, and screw God, and screw religion, and screw this, and screw that. But the thing is, what I didn't know until I'd been around for a while, what I couldn't admit until I'd been around for a while, was that every morning of my life, I came to believe and I turned my will and my life over to the care of something else. I turned it over to the care of alcohol, booze, drugs, other people, institutions. Generally, whatever I bitched about all day, that was my higher power. Step two is very simple. I don't need to know what God looks like. I just have to come to believe that there's something bigger than me and it can restore me to sanity. Sobriety has provided me an opportunity to study academically like divinity in this crazy way, different religions. I like to think of myself as spiritually promiscuous. I sleep around with a lot of belief systems and mythologies, and I like that, and I'm really into it, but it's been an adventure, but I honestly can stand here at 25 years and say I know less about God than I ever did, and it works better than it ever has. Like, one other thing, like, this was not psychotherapy, this was inventories that revealed this to me. It wasn't long before I'd done a few fourth and fifth steps that I realized that my resentments against God, or my higher power, and my resentments against my parents were eerily similar. So I spent years in AA building a higher power, like Build-A-Bear. Well, my higher power is going to be gentle, and my higher power is going to be kind, and I would build this higher power that I wanted to set up and say, now that's what I'm turning my will and my life over to the care of today. Today, it's more of a matter of removing things from my higher power. Like all that crazy, like my crazy alcoholic mother, and my raging untreated Al-Anon stepdad, and my abandoning father. That's always who winds up being God in my head if I'm not careful and if I'm not vigilant with step two. The first time I took step three, my sponsor and I got on our knees and we said the third step prayer together. And I had tingles and I felt lighter and I felt different. And I felt like everything had changed. I suddenly had this feeling of I could and things are going to get better. And I ran out and for 3 days I was on fire. And on day four, I was ready to get drunk again. It was nuts. So, you know, in the book it says, being convinced we are step three. And then it goes on to say, you know, next we launch on a course of vigorous action. So here's how step three works for me, just for me. When I get to step three, I make a decision to turn my will and my life over into my higher power's care. I practice turning my will and my life over to my higher power's care by working the rest of the steps. Because at this point, I haven't really searched what's going on within me. I haven't seen myself from a different perspective. I haven't been willing to turn all of that over, and I haven't tried to clear my side of the street. So I would love it if it were a three-step program. It's just never worked that way for me. Like, I make that decision at step three, and at that moment, I give up as much as I can. And then I give up the rest by working the rest of the steps. Step four is a lifesaver for me. I no longer look at it as the big scary monster. I'll do one in a heartbeat, like every time I need one. So I just write down my resentments, my fears, harms done, sexual inventory, and then I admit to God, to myself, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. It's really simple. I just turn it over to my sponsor, and he handles it. it's like, I mean, I don't give him my four step, and I just like, okay, I'm here. What do I do? You know what to do, damn it. You know, okay, well, all right, here we go. I always remember to bring myself to the fifth step, admitted to myself and to another human being and to my higher power, the exact nature of my wrongs. So the point isn't to say this is what I did wrong. The point is to find the exact nature of my wrongs. And that, I always need a little bit of help getting there. Step 6 and 7, that's two paragraphs in the big book, right? So I've heard a lot of AA theological debates about 6 and 7, about, you know, keeping it simple or making it really complicated. This is what has worked for me. I've done a lot of different steps 6 and 7s over time, but this last time, the most powerful one I did was this. How do I become willing to have God remove these defects of character? Because my only job, I feel, in step 6 is to become willing to let go. I can't manage my own defects. I have no business performing brain surgery on myself. So how do I become willing to let go? I started writing them thank you letters. And I took that from our sister program of Al-Anon. And I went out and I laid out these defects of character and I wrote each of them a thank you letter. Because these were things that I view as kind of, they were trying to help. You know, like, you know, a scary situation comes along, they're just like, ooh, I can help. Let's lie about it. And, you know, it's like, you know, you peel back that onion, you work the steps, 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 peel back that onion and get to deeper layers, and I get beyond the point where it thinks, where it's beyond I'm selfish and I'm self-centered and I want the cookie or I want to keep the cookie or, you know, this kind of thing. And it gets to the point where I realize these are all things, these tactics that I have that were designed to keep me safe. And when I was a child growing up in a violent alcoholic environment, they really worked. But today as an adult in the adult world, they don't work anymore. Again, I can't remove them from myself and I don't want to. So what I do is I write them a thank you letter and I tell them that I'm letting them go. And I went out and I bought the most adult stationery that I could find. And when it came time to humbly ask, I did say the seven-step prayer, but I wrote those thank you notes on the stationery, and I said the prayer, I threw them into the fire, and I watched the smoke go up. And here's what's happened. They're all gone, and I'm now perfect. Doing that little ritual for me, it took like 60% of the power out of it. And now when those character defects pop up and they rear their ugly head or they say, I want to help, it's my job to just say to my higher power, I'm willing to let this go a little bit more. And I leave it entirely in my higher power's hands. Step 8 was the end. This is such a cruel program. Step 8 was the end of my victimhood. It was where I stopped being this poor little victim trying to make my way in the world and amidst a bunch of assholes. And it's when I started to become willing to own me. And here's the thing with step 9. I grew up in active alcoholism. I am an alcoholic even though I'm sober. A big part of this disease is perceptions, what I've experienced on both sides of it. And I've really good at making you think that my bullshit perception is reality. And that can make somebody think that they're crazy. So I've, you know, in 25 years, I've had three sponsors. I find one and I stick with them and I don't let go. The last one had to die before I let go of him. But we've all come to agreements on my night steps. Even the living amends that I'm making every day, I still make it a point to go forward and get eyeball to eyeball and say, this is where I was wrong. And try to, you know, it's not about saying I'm sorry. It's about saying I broke your chair. Can I help? Can I buy you a new chair? Can I fix your chair? Can I do this for you? Because I've been guilty of vomiting my reality out into the universe so much that other people can think that they're crazy when they know that this is the damn truth over here. So for me, even for living amends, it's always been important to go forward and make eyeball to eyeball direct amends, except when to do so, obviously. Step 10, I do the selfish, dishonest, resentful, and afraid when I do it. I haven't done it in a couple of weeks. I'm busted. 11 is an adventure. That's all I got to say about 11, and it's going to be time for me to shut up in a second. But 12, you know, my life today, my circumstances are really good. what I deal with most of the time is raising two small children who are 4 and 6. And as I raise my children, I relive my childhood. And it's tough. I've had a few mornings where I'm just collapsed on the kitchen floor in tears, reliving some old episode that happened a long time ago. But there's a lot of joy there as well. And raising my children helps heal a small part of me. That's how I carry this to the best of my ability, these principles in all of my affairs. We have a little thing on the refrigerator because I have to use it every damn day with my kids. You know, how do we apologize? You know, this is what I did. This is why that was wrong, and here's what I'm going to try to do in the future. And that's how I practice these principles in all my affairs today. My circumstances are good, but I'm reliving things that were not happy. You know, and all those things that happened in childhood, you know, they weren't the reason I drank. Because I know other people who had it much worse. They don't drink. I mean, they're pretty screwed up, but they don't drink over it. You know, I drink because I have an allergy to alcohol, as it lays out in the doctor's opinion. As far as service work, you know, I used to do an awful lot of it. I was involved in just about everything you could imagine, GSR, DCM, all that kind of stuff. And then when I had two kids, all that backed up. I secretary a few meetings, and I do what I can do today. I miss it. You know, if you have an opportunity to jump into service work, please do. You know, I'm just in a phase in life where I can't do as much as I used to. And never discount how you come to be of service. Just show up and be authentic with yourself. Because there are a lot of ways to reach people, and some of them are real flashy and some of them aren't. But personally, for me, in the past years that I've been sober, I'm always going to have a very special place in my heart for those crazy, co-ed, sober, skinny-dipping alcoholics who forced so much joy and levity into my life on such a hard night, and who listened to that little voice inside them that said, "Don't let him be alone," instead of listening to me when I tried to kick them out. Thank you for listening to me.